by the parties, and I'm certainly not an attorney, but it seems like that whole area hasn't been looked at by anyone yet.
Mr. Chairman, I certainly agree that if this was done without the knowledge of the industry, and I, for one, am willing to take the sworn testimony of a state employee, Don Wilson, of the Department of Labor, Wage and Hour Division. My point, I am not here to defend the Department of Labor, and if they, I have been on the receiving end of regulations I didn't know anything about. But, Mr. Chairman, from the time I'm made aware of those regulations, Dresser Industries in 1979, I believe it is incumbent until the law is changed to obey the law, and they were undoubtedly aware of it in 1979. There can be no question. And I do not intend to cast aspersions. I think that it has been a masterful job of what I consider to be hiding the ball. This is a private bailout bill for people who've been breaking the law. And that is the central issue that this committee should consider. I think the wisdom of the flexible work week, or the lack of wisdom, is not something you should really consider. I think you should consider bailing out people who knowingly and intentionally violated the law at the expense of those other employers who did obey the law. Those people, you can't reward the lawbreakers in favor of those and not reward those who chose to follow the law.
I guess I'd suggest there's nobody at this committee trying to do that. Representative Winting?
Well, in regard to your statements, Mr. Chairman, it was clear even if for your concerns are only addressed for 1 year out of 2.5 year, or 4.5 year period, that even if the Department of Labor totally screwed up and snuck something through trying to catch everybody, that only applied for 1 year, and you had another 3.5 years in which the law continued to be broken with full knowledge.
Yeah, I guess that depends on if Mr. Barcott had been the attorney on the other side, of course he would be singing the other story and saying that, you know, nothing prevails until we get the court to settle it. It seems to me like the key to his statement was there is that one party backed off, and I presume you're referring to the Department of Labor. They stood back and waited for the courts to decide. And when the courts decided, they moved in and said, that is the law.
I was referring to the workers who were waiting to see if the courts would uphold their rights.
Yeah, which in this case would have been the Department of Labor. They kind of stood back, right? So you see that there were two kind of sides standing here waiting for the court to decide whether the law was in fact there or not.
Are you saying that it's proper if you challenge a regulation that you don't follow it until the courts settle it?
I'm not saying proper at all. I'm saying that appears to be what happened here to me.
Well, yeah, it is clear. They challenged the regulation and then chose not to follow it, even though in my mind, and I'm certainly not an attorney any more than you are, that the law is the law until it's declared unconstitutional.
Yeah, see, I'm a little bit confused. If there's 100 employers out there doing it, why the Department of Labor wasn't bringing action against 100 employers? I'm a little bit confused. If they were so sure that the law was there, what happened here? And the more I find back here, I really don't know what's going on here. It seems to me like the more I keep hearing this man Wilson's name, the more I keep wondering just what did go on here. Representative Blum?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to repeat this statement during the hearings on this legislation or any other coming before the committee. It seems to me people have a responsibility to know what the law is. You're in business, I'm in business. We both have to deal with regulations that we don't like at all. And sometimes I'm surprised by those regulations. I'm surprised at the lack of understanding of the state agencies that adopt them. But I have to abide by the regulations. And just speaking for myself, that this isn't a court of law, and I guess we don't have to take the position that ignorance to law is no defense. But as a member of the committee, I think that ignorance to law is an awfully weak excuse, especially when people are in business. If somebody's running a lemonade stand in the backyard and they don't know about labor regulation, well, I might listen to their argument. But I have a hard time doing it when somebody hasn't been in business a number of years and you would expect them to, as a matter of course of business, be aware of regulations in this, when they're being published, certainly when they become part of the administrative law of the state. That's my statement. Make it.
I guess I have some trouble with that. When you read this thing and see if you drew the same conclusions I did, it seems to me like the whole case turned on two words, definitions and interpretations. And it seems to me like Mr. Lawrenson, in his February 10th, 1978 letter of opinion, simply set it out that the legislature was searching or trying, when it made statute to, or made the, yeah, made the law follow the federal law, you know, and you know, he can, more than one time he brings it up in there, and I'm a little bit confused as to just how this all took place. And I don't believe you clarified it up. I still don't see any evidence there that there was any attempt on the Department of Labor's part to get out there and notify anybody. And with all due respect to Representative Malone, I have been in business for 20 years, and the Department of Labor, to my knowledge, has never made a law affecting me that they haven't come to me and notified me. Maybe that's because we've been IBEW contractors, and a lot of times the notices go to people who are so registered that seems like the Department of Labor has a responsibility to other contractors other than just union contractors to get out there and get to them, and that doesn't appear to have happened, nor does the action against anybody appear to have happened across the board, just in little places. I'd like to ask one more question, Mr. Barkow. How many of these claims do you, did you say you had five suits? Is that what you said?
There are five suits which raise issues that are the subject of this litigation. There are other ancillary suits, a total number of eight.
These are five individuals working, suing, or
three of them are class actions. Two are large class actions. Dresser involves a class of 75 to 80. Slumberjay involves a class of 75 to 80. There is a third class action of about 25 to 30, and then several other individual cases involving seven to eight plaintiffs each. We represent about 200 workmen, if all of the members of the class choose to opt in when they have that choice.
Okay, I guess that's what I needed to have that cleared just for me. Representative Winty?
Are these union employees?
They are not union employees. This particular industry is that by tradition and heritage comes out of an area of the United States which is not a heavily unionized area, and they are not union employees at all.
Okay, so the contracts we're talking about are individual contracts?
Yes.
Signed between the individual and the company?
Yes.
Although
they are verbal contracts for the most part. There are no written contracts.
There are no written contracts.
There
so the
no
contracts written. That we've been talking about that set things out are just verbal agreements. Someone's hired the
and they agree to go to work, and under the terms of our Wage and Hour Act, that Wage and Hour Act is read into the contract of hire by statute to protect the workman in an unequal bargaining position.
Among the employees who question the FWW in this case, did they take that to their employer?
They did to Dresser Industries.
But they continued, after taking that to their employer, they continued to work at with through being paid by the FWW.
That's right, and when the United States Supreme Court denied cert, they were told, go see a lawyer if you want your money.
Are they still employed by?
They just recently, some of them are, some of them are not. A gentleman you'll be hearing from, one of the plaintiffs in one of the class actions, has just recently left Dresser Industries on apparently amicable terms with the company.
Further questions of Mr. Barkow? Representative Liska?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sir, on the In 1982, in the legislature, when the Senate put in Senate Bill 886 trying to address this, were you familiar with that particular piece of legislation?
I was familiar with three pieces of legislation which were in front of the legislature last term. I'm not familiar by number, but I'm certain I was at the time.
Well, that was a piece of legislation that any liability arising out of the regulatory prohibition be extinguished retroactively. Bill to accomplish this was Senate Bill 886, introduced in the Senate last legislature. The bill failed, incidentally.
That bill did fail. There was one other attempt, and I believe two other attempts at similar bills with just slightly different slants attempting to accomplish the same purpose, and they all failed. They did not get out of committee.
Are there further questions of Mr. Barcott?
Excuse me. Was
Representative Winty?
Was that the first committee referral? They didn't proceed at all after introduction?
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Barcott, for coming
down. Thank you very
much. We need to kind of chug along here a little bit. John Eshelman?
We send one of the staff up to check on the score of the basketball game. Yes. We're beating the Senate.
Who's playing basketball?
Did the House play in the Senate?
John, we need to have you state your name for the record, as we are recording electronically, and then proceed to your statement in a manner such as you will, please.
Okay, my name is John Eshelman. I'm from Wasilla. I've been in Alaska all my life. I'm also a member of the Alaska Wage Security Association, which is formed to help protect the rights of workers and fair and equitable wages. I've been employed by Dresser Atlas, or was up until a couple of weeks ago, for about 2 years. I was a wireline operator. I worked under the FWW plan, worked under the new system. I was in completions, I was in open haul, and when I left, I was in production logging. In that work, I handled explosives, dealing with blasting caps and the sorts, radioactive equipment, heavy equipment. I did a lot of welding, mechanical repair, which I, you know, hardly classify as unskilled labor. Everybody I worked with is handling explosives and radioactive materials, so it takes some skill in what you're doing. When I was hired on March 5th, 1981, went through the proper procedures and all, and when I was getting ready to leave, I'd ask, you know, the secretary was filling out all the paperwork, you know, on how, what we were going to be paid an hour. She couldn't really tell me because she said it was really confusing, but she said I'd make about $50,000 a year. Said okay, you know, went on slope. But at the same time, you know, I found out later that they were being sued by Harley Woody and over the possibility of illegal pay plans. I am a plaintiff in the suit against Dresser, and there is no set figure amount of what, you know, will come out of the suit for myself. I've estimated, you know, just as a guess, $25,000. Could go up, could go down, you know, that's just something that has to be decided. But after I filed my suit with Dresser, things, you know, naturally turned for the worse. They didn't really appreciate the situation. I stayed in the shop more most of the time. I went on lower paying jobs. We receive a job bonus. Every time you go on a job, you receive 0.98% of the ticket. Less than that if there's more than three operators. There was different times, you know, always being checked. I was always, you know, checked to see if I was doing anything wrong, because it was, they were trying to terminate me, is my feelings, which is, I guess, is typical, I guess, because they didn't like me talking about the lawsuit. And to give you an idea, Al Rosentrader, who's district engineer up there, had made the statement to several other employees that I was a model employee, so I was not someone who just sat around and didn't do anything. I'd like to touch on you how I come about to file suit on Dresser. After working at Dresser, I started in the spring, midsummer. The guys had quite a bit of talk going on about Harley Woody's case, which I looked into, and it was on a similar situation. And so we waited till it had settled. And at the time, John Martin had come up and told us we were going to have a pay change. And so we did. And at the time, I asked him, you know, if there was a pay change, the problems with the pay system, of what we're going to have for possible back wage settlement. And at the time, he told me that Dresser did not feel they owed us anything. If we felt any different, that we should go seek legal counsel. At which time I did. I took about a month and a half or so to look into this. talked to Woody, Harley Woody, who's originally sued Dresser Swaco, and he recommended me to contact Michael Barcott, which I did. Mike has stated this earlier, but the fact of the matter is, if they would have changed in 79, when Harley sued, I wouldn't be here today. You know, we wouldn't be discussing this bill, because there would be no case. But, the fact of the matter, here we are. If the bill passes, I stand to lose the money that I've worked for, and so do the employees that I worked with. And, to me, it doesn't seem anywhere fair. And one of the questions seemed to be come up in the time I was down here one time before, and I come down this time. And one of the questions that was raised was people that wanted to know, well, how were you paid? You know, $50,000 seems like a lot of money. Aren't you happy, you know? Well, comparable, say a roughneck on a rig, he makes 75. Of course, I think with the last increase there up to 80. He works 12 hours on, 12 hours off schedule. We work around the clock. Many times we're up 30 hours at a time, 30, 40 hours. Most I think I've ever been up to 50 hours at one time, working around the clock. I'd like to pass out these examples of what we were paid on a sliding scale.
Somebody from the city can do that for you.
Okay.
These were secured from Dresser Atlas when they went down to look into my files under this suit. The first page just primarily deals with, you know, a typed out explanation, and they also wrote up three different examples, which on the next page is example. You had a weekly base, then you had a bonus, which, you know, range always varied because you didn't know what jobs were going on. Some weeks you didn't have any bonus in your hours. We were guaranteed 105 hours a week, which was 15 hours a day. We worked 10 in the shop if there was no jobs or if you went out in the field. And you take and you'd add your base to your bonus, divide it by the total number of hours you worked, gives you a hourly rate. Okay, first example is in here. Then you have a halftime, you subtract 40 from the total number of hours you work, add that to your total number of hours you work, which gives you into a halftime rate. Multiply that times your hourly rate, which gives you a figure. The first example they proposed to show was 114 hours the man worked with $506.33 bonus, and added to your base of 288, comes out with a $6.97 hourly rate. The first week, the man made $1,052.47. The second example they have, he worked 120 hours. His pace went down to 662, made $1,059. So effectively, if a man worked 120 hours instead of 114, he would get an extra $6.73 for the 6 hours work that he worked, extra work that he had in. Third example they proposed was the 288, same base, same bonus, only he worked 130 hours. That's the third page back. There the man made $1,069.25 for the week. Over the very first example, if he'd worked 114 hours instead of 130, he made $10.05 for the extra 10 hours that he worked, effectively just about a dollar an hour, which, if you compare it to our new system, there's, you know, we had a considerable increase in pay when we went to the new system. Contrary to what's being told, one operator, I don't want to give his name because reprisal, he made under the 2-in-1, we worked 2-in-1 up until just at the first year of 81, 82. On the fluctuating work week, he made in the high 60s. Okay, when we went to 1-in-1, which is a third less you spend on the slope, you spend at home, he made in the 80s. And that's, you know, just one example. Myself, I was there, I believe I started in March of 81, and I had that year, I believe I made $50,000 in Dresser. My next year I worked 1-in-1, I was still at $50,000 in Dresser. You know, I worked less time, still made the same money. So, effectively, the way I figure, I'm no accountant, your cost per man is higher on the new system, because when you get up working 120, 130 hours, instead of getting a dollar an hour, you're still getting your hourly wage, which at the time, I think an operator starts at $11 or $12 an hour. You're getting that plus anything over 8 or over 40 is time and a half, which would be $17, $18 an hour, which makes a big difference if you add it all up in a man's time. So, and the thing about the fluctuating work week, you know, we, up until recently, we never fluctuated less than 56 an hour. That's the lowest that we work in a week, because we've had a declining market. So we have had cutbacks because we're not working as many hours in the shop. And we're still going on jobs, you work around the clock till the job is finished. I'd like to, you know, express my opinion about class members that I represent, people I work on the slope. More of them would be like to be down here. For one, is expense. That's why I'd like to see a teleconference at the Wasilla or Anchorage area. If you can get one in Anchorage, I'd appreciate it. People can make it to Anchorage. But one of the biggest problems with people riding down here, even the legislators or whatever, they're afraid of reprisal from their employer. And I can't really blame them because, you know, they have mouths to feed and kids to clothe and that kind of thing. So that's a major problem with, you know, people that I represent, you know, they're afraid to come forward and say anything. Still, working on this schedule, an operator averages about 60,000 a year, 55 to 60,000 a year, which some people say, well, that's still a lot of money. When you consider the hours and the year worked compared to an ARCO employee or a roughneck or that kind, it is still on the lower end of the scale, okay? So there's no complaints about the $56,000 a year, but just so you understand, we're not out working a 12-hour shift. Or going to 8-hour changeouts three times a day. When the man works out in the field, he stays out there from one end, you know, till the job's finished, which is around the clock. And that's basically all I have, other than I urge you to not pass House Bill 223. And I'm open to any questions that you have.
Thank you. Are there questions for John, representing Wendy?
Did you have a written contract?
No. There was nothing written. Like I said, the secretary, who isn't working there now, but I mean, at the time, she couldn't figure out the pay system. She said, you know, I can't really tell you what the hourly wage would be, but you make about $50,000 a year. And just about everybody up there was under the same category. And there's about four employees at the time once I got up there and got to know some people that honestly could work the pay schedule to where they could figure out exactly what they were making.
Okay, so purposes of changing that contract, since that's what it is, I guess, a verbal contract, it's been reported here today that it'd be difficult to change all those contracts in a short period of time. They couldn't do that in 79, or they chose not to do that. They did do it after the Supreme Court acted, or refused to act. If they were to change their pay schedule, what would they have to do to change that contract? To essentially tell you
just
we're paying
just essentially what they did before. They just come up and said, we're having a new pay schedule, and we had a new pay schedule. There was, John did come up one time before that because he said, you know, we're looking at, you know, what's going to happen in the courts over this. And 7 weeks later, we had a new pay system. I mean, I don't see what the problem is. If that would have been done in 79, we wouldn't be sitting here today. But they would have had a larger expense in their employees. This is true. The thing, I'm no accountant, but you can sit down and figure out the figures, or you could, you know, I could try and get you some people's paychecks and show you the difference, the year-to-date W-2s, and it costs more per man. Everybody likes the new system they're on. They don't want to go back to the FWW. They're scared to death that that's what's going to happen. They don't want anything to do with it. They're happier, you know, they're happy the way they're working.
Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Eshelman, since you just recently left Dresser Company, it appears you worked for them under the new regulations, and also, as you've indicated, prior to the implementation of the new regulations. There was some testimony, I believe, by Mr. Barcott that under the flexible work week, we'd be expected to work up to about 18 hours a day. And maybe I think I heard you say even around the clock,
mm-hmm.
And then your compensation under that type of a plan was some base, and then sometimes it'd be a bonus, and sometimes it wouldn't. And then, but anyway, you made around 50-60,000 a year. That was mm-hmm. sort of what
you're looking at. That's about the average.
Then on the new plan, you're actually so you were around. According to Mr. Barcott, on the average, about 18 hours a day, more or less.
That's what it'll average out over the whole. Now,
yeah.
I have lots of time sheets that are 130 hours in a week, okay? I mean, that's, when you usually, I mean, if you catch a job, we rarely have a job that's less than 25 hours. And in the cold climate, I can guarantee you there's constantly problems. And when you have problems, you got to stay there till you get them fixed.
Then I assume that would be one of those weeks when you might get a bonus if you put 130 hours.
Correct, exactly.
Okay, then what is the, and then now you're working like a 12-hour a day shift. And I was looking at this stuff, it's your figures here where you get $6.11 and under different types of 662 and so forth. What is the hourly wage now?
Hourly wage for an operator.
For yourself.
My hourly wage was $12.94 when I left. That's just an operator. I mean, you have junior operator receives no bonus at hourly wage, and you have operator step one, step two, step three, senior and on up. Okay. And my hourly wage is $12.94, I believe, what it was
plus
when I left.
Overtime.
Plus overtime, plus bonus.
Still pay a bonus.
Correct. I mean, they pay an overtime on the bonus. They pay a halftime on the bonus. So if you get a $500 bonus, they still pay you an additional amount of money on that bonus because you were working overtime when you earned that bonus.
Just one more question. How do you accrue a bonus then under the new plan?
Same as the old plan. When you go out on a job, they go out and do a production logging job. They go out and do a static survey. You know, you go out, you rig up, you take your equipment out, you rig up your crane, you rig up your lubricator, you go in the hole, you come out of the hole after the log's done, you rig down, you go back to shop. Provided you completed the service, they charge the customer X amount of dollars.
Gotcha.
And then you receive a percentage off that.
I understand that. Thank you.
John, you said you worked in the logging industry before you went to work for Dresser?
No, that's what I was doing when I worked for Dresser.
Oh, okay. I thought you said logging.
No.
Tree logging.
No, oil.
I was going to point out to you that logging industry is exempt. They still use FWW in the logging industry.
Now, this is oil well. Everybody confused. What do you do at Prudhoe? I work in the, I'm in the logging business. There's no trees at Prudhoe.
John, when you went into Dresser to get the job, is that the first time you ever worked around that kind of industry?
I've worked at Vico before.
They have the same kind of thing as Vico?
No, they have you work for an hourly wage, time and a half after 8, time and a half after 40, and guaranteed time and a half on Saturday and Sundays.
So you came from that kind of system?
10 hours a day, 12 hours
and
a day job.
You walked over to Dresser and went to work without knowing what you were being paid?
Correct. I primarily went to Dresser because of a better schedule. When I worked at Vico, I worked 4, 5, and 6 weeks at a time, and at that time with a family, you know, it's nice to be home a little earlier. We worked a 2-in-1 schedule at Dresser, and then we went to a 1-in-1 schedule at Dresser.
I hate to see you stay confused all the time, but again, if you worked over here and you knew exactly what you're doing, you went over here and you went to work because you had a schedule and you didn't know how much they were paying you.
No, but when I was told $50,000 a year, that sounded fine to me. That sounds like a lot of money. When you get up there and you're working around the clock, 30 and 40 hours at a time, and you start figuring out how you're paid, you start to wonder what's happening, and that's when I started to look into. Of course, there was talk in the shop, and that's when I started looking into what the situation was.
I guess I'm still somewhat confused. You went to the slope without knowing how long you were going to be gone or what you were going to do?
When you work for contract companies where they work for a contract, you work until the job is done. I'm sure, I don't know what kind of work you did in your business, but when you work up there, when we were working for Vico, they worked by the contract and you worked until you were done. If you're installing pipe or whatever we were doing at the time. There's a projected time when you're going to end the job, but in weather conditions or what have you, that slows you up. I mean, there's times when we didn't know how long we'd be gone at Vico. Dresser is a different story.
I guess I'll have to stay confused. I guess I'm not going to get the answers because I can assure you that there's no electrician that works for me that doesn't know where he's going, how long he's going to be there, and exactly to the penny how much he's going to be paid. He may not be able to read his rule or bend a piece of pipe, but he does know how he's going to be paid. And he certainly knows how to calculate that. And he knows how to do that before he goes. And even though he's not allowed to, most of the time he has almost the contract in writing to get whatever hours he's going to get before he gets there, too, or he don't go.
Mr. Chairman, I commend you for that, and I suppose that you are not subject to $20 million in
possible liability too.
I guess I paid out my 20 along the way. Plus some money, I suspect. Are there further questions of Mr. Eichelman? If not, the next witness on the line is, I presume this is your brother, Robert. Robert, since we are recording electronically, I'll need to ask you to state your name for the record and then proceed with your statement in a manner such as you will, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Robert Eshelman, and I'm here today representing myself because this bill has a direct influence on my future. I am a former Dresser employee, and I am also a long-term Alaskan. I reside in North Kenai. I am also a plaintiff in an individual lawsuit with Dresser Industries, and I am a member of the AWSA, Alaska Wage Security Association, and I'm voluntarily representing myself and other people within the state. The impact of this litigation and the way this bill proceeds to take care of this litigation on my part, I am suing Dresser on a little bit different pay scheme than my brother. I was not paid under the flexible work week. I was paid as a salaried non-exempt employee. My capacity for Dresser Industries is a field technician, and I repaired the surface and subsurface electronics. My salary consisted of several components: a Houston base, an Alaska allowance, and isolation pay. This was not a written contract. It was a verbal contract. And I went to work for Dresser on October 2nd of 1978. I was hired in Kenai primarily, and that I would transfer later to the North Slope as the North Slope District developed. I had no question on my pay. At the time, I was freshly out of college, and I thought it was a fairly good wage. However, as time went on, myself and several other salaried non-exempt employees began to question the way we were being paid. It seems as how our overtime was computed strictly on our Houston base. Therefore, the more overtime we put in, or the more time we put in, the less money we made. We questioned this, and at one time, after I transferred to the North Slope, I was asked to represent all the salaried and non-exempt employees for the North Slope District in a communications meeting with personnel from Houston. They happened to be the Vice President of North American Operations, the Head of Industrial Relations, and the Head of Personnel for Dresser Atlas. At the time, we had three major items that we would like to have communicated that were, at the time, we thought were unjust. Number one, we wanted to go to a week-in-a-week schedule. Number two, we wanted our overtime changed. We felt it was unjust. And number three, we wanted an eye care package in addition to our medical and dental plan. There was no basic comment on the week-in-a-week schedule. We were working two and one. They felt that was a fair schedule for the type of work we were doing, and for the similar companies involved, that was a just schedule. However, when it came to the overtime and we explained our situation to these people, they said at the time, well, gee, you guys have a valid claim here. It's true that you're not making very much money. As a Houston tech, he's making, say, $10 an hour. As a North Slope tech, away from home and family, you're still only making $10 an hour. Well, nothing was done about this. We were told that, of course, it's going to be checked into. That was in the summer of 1981. As of November, the preceding litigation that had taken place under the Swaco case, which I might add to your confusion about the fact that Dresser didn't know that they were going to be sued, or they didn't know the regulation. The talk about this lawsuit was rampant on the North Slope. That was a subject of great interest among all the managers in the camp. Our pay plan, the salaried non-exempt personnel, was changed approximately in the first week of December of 81, a month after they changed the flexible work week plan for the other employees. Well, this brought some surprise. Well, geez, communications meetings do work. Since we were non-union, Dresser, and as has been stated before, is strictly most against unions per se, and it's not generally a union-type company. So therefore, we felt that we were doing the right thing negotiating with our management people, which is what the process was all about. Well, our pay system changed, and we were rather amazed, we're pleased. Our pay almost doubled, and I can give some figures later on my own personal pay to show this. Well, after the lawsuit was filed that my brother filed, there were some various harassment problems involved. He was, of course, harassed severely, and it drifted over to me. As of October 29th of 1982, I was terminated. There was no apparent reason given other than a poor job performance. I might add, in 1981, my W-2 form was in excess of $60,000. That was 2-in-1, anywhere from 15 to 18 hours average. Many times my timesheets were 100 to 20 to 130 hours total. As of 1982, since I started working week and week in the month of late January, and since I only worked to the end of the 10th month, my W-2 form for last year is about $55,000. And I would like to dispel the idea that the pay was the same. My pay practically doubled. My time and half rate went from somewhere near $12 an hour to almost $28 an hour when they started paying or computing my overtime on my whole overall compensation. If this bill passes, it will reduce the liability that Dresser owes me and that I feel Dresser owes me in past wages that I feel that I earned. I felt that I dealt with Dresser and the division of Dresser Atlas rather honestly. I did not sue. My litigation took place in the month of December of 1982, 2.5 months after I was terminated, or approximately 2 months. My statute of limitations started when our pay system changed in December of 81. Therefore, I felt I dealt rather fairly with Dresser in trying to communicate the problems with salaried non-exempt people. Since then, of course, various rumors have gotten back to me. Some of my friends have been harassed to deal with me, and there will certainly be more POMs against this bill from people that are actively involved with it if the harassment idea wasn't over their heads. As my brother stated, people do have families to feed and people to clothe. Dresser is a large company. It's international. It's non-Alaskan. And it's well staffed with legal service. My rights under the law, as I see them, that's the only defense I have, since I am non-union, to battle such a large and diversified company. And if they have the right or the privilege of coming here and changing the law retroactively, I think I'm being dealt unfairly with. And I also feel that Dresser knowingly and willingly did not abide by the law. There was no attempt to change our pay system until after they'd been sued the first time, and then they waited another month to change it for us. Unfortunately, since there are under 25 people, we cannot file a class action for our group of employees. I am filing this litigation individually, and the claim is not that large, since due to the fact that there is a 2-year statute of limitations, and I have let over almost a year and 2 months slide by before I decided to sue, basically because I thought the system was that you could negotiate, especially in our position as being non-union. Obviously, that's not true. And I would like at this time to say I hope the committee does not pass this piece of legislation. And I'm willing to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Robert. President Lister?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Eshelman, I believe Mr. Barcutt, in his testimony, said that the lawsuit that he's representing was basically all lower 48. individuals. That's what I have on my note.
Are you implying that the people in this class action or the litigants are basically?
Right, lower 48, non-union lower 48 individuals. What's your perception, and this just from our committee information, from each bucket, what percentage would you say of an individual you worked with were last and higher to be really affected by this?
Well, it was a good mix. I wouldn't say that Dresser hired all Alaskans. There were certainly some transferred people, and certainly some people that have been hired since then, since I left, that were non-Alaskans. But for the most part, these are Alaskan people, and even the people that have been brought from Houston or from Texas or from other places outside have decided to reside in the state of Alaska. I do not think primarily this lawsuit covers people that just live in the lower 48. There are a lot of Alaskans that this piece of legislation affects.
Thank you.
Representative Winty?
Mr. Chairman, maybe we could address the rules. I'd like to offer Mr. Barcott the opportunity to clarify. I've been trying to keep pretty clear notes, and my notes seem to indicate that he told us that these industries primarily hired Alaskans. And if you got the opposite, I guess, could you clarify whether that, which version is that?
I would appreciate the opportunity. They are primarily Alaskans that I am representing. The companies are primarily outside companies.
Oh, yes. I know that. I just...
Thank you.
Are there further questions of Robert? If not, I'd just like to ask you, Robert, do you consider yourself employed or were employed, or maybe you are? I don't even know what your present status is as a professional employee.
Well, I considered myself rather professional. I was certainly skilled. I hold an associate's in applied science with a major in electronics from the University of Alaska. I graduated with honors, so I don't feel that I'm an unskilled type person. I feel that I'm semi-professional.
Okay, then you said a salaried non-exempt employee. What's a salaried non-exempt employee?
There are several classifications of employees. There were the hourly, of course, and then there were salaried non-exempt and then salary exempt. Hourly, getting an hourly wage, salaried non-exempt. I received a salary, and I was authorized overtime. I was not authorized any bonus whatsoever. And then there were salary exempt personnel, which are given a salary and a bonus.
See, clearly under the exemptions in 2310.055, under 9 of that section, it says an individual employed in a bona fide executive, administrative, or professional capacity, or in a capacity of outside salesman, or a salesman who's employed on a straight-time commission basis. Those are exempt employees under the statute. If you are clearly a professional employee and in a salary position, you're exempt from the statute anyway.
Yes, but we were authorized overtime.
Okay, I guess...
And we were not paid the overtime on our total Alaska compensation. And what seems strange to us, since we did some calculating, using other salary comparisons, and I will mention two names, Ohio Alaskan Petroleum Company and ARCO Alaska Incorporated, employees equivalent to my skill and training, who only worked 12-hour on, 12-hour off shifts, were making anywhere from $15,000 to $30,000 more a year than myself or my other fellow employees.
I guess I'm having trouble understanding how that's too relevant. There are several contractors in the field that make more money than we do, too, but I don't quit and go to work for that. Representative
Malone? No. I guess my question is, Mr. Eshelman, were those people that you mentioned working for those other companies on the same sort of creative overtime calculation, or are they on standard overtime calculation, or do you know?
Well, if you're saying creative overtime, is, in other words, is the system Dresser used first? No, ARCO Alaska and Ohio Alaska Drilling Company, they seem to abide by the law of the state. Their overtime is paid time and a half after 8 or over 40. ARCO and Ohio both work week and a week, as they have since probably day one when they started their major employee hire.
Thank you.
Representative Winty?
Mr. Chairman, if the previous testimony by Mr. Becker and Mr. Martin indicating that these employees were paid fairly and equitably, if that's relevant, I would assume that his testimony indicating that like work in other Alaska firms firms and situations getting paid $20,000-$30,000 more for the same kind of work would be relevant to balance off whether that is fair and equitable.
Yeah, I suspect you could look around probably and find firms that are paying less too, so I don't know where you draw the fair and equitable line. Do you feel like you were paid fairly and equitably?
Not at this time, no.
Did you at the time?
No, at the time we did not. That's why we negotiated with Houston management to try and change our pay system.
But you feel like you got someplace with your negotiations?
We thought we were on the right track. I didn't think I would have to sue to get what I thought was mine under the law. And obviously that's what I've had to do.
Are there further questions around that? If not, thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have a long list, and I would like to kind of go to 10 o'clock, unless there's some objection by Representative Malone.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any objection going to 10 o'clock, but I need to take a few minutes here to check out a committee meeting to check on one of these teleconferences that legislative delegations hold that prevent the use of the system by the committee. So, excuse myself for a few minutes.
Can you ask him if we could take the time up?
I set them up, and we'll take it over right now.
Representative Hayes?
I don't have any objection, but I was under the impression that we were going to go until about 10 o'clock in order to deal with out of town people who wanted to testify. Mr. Sofo, of course, is just across the street.
Are there? I can't tell. Let's see. Yeah, I can't. See, I don't really know how many of these guys are here and how many of them aren't. Obviously, see, this is Juno. Is Jerry Sheehan? He's here. And Larry, let's see, Larry Compton.
Oh, he left.
Richard Grohl. And Paul Preston. So, I think in view of that, we probably should spend the time. Hate to do this to Mr. Suffolk, but because you are very close, and these other gentlemen did travel from afar, since you waited so long to get on the list. Perhaps we could take that. I think that suggestion is well put, and we probably ought to move down the list to Jerry Sheehan then.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Jerry Sheehan. I'm the Alaska Division Manager at Gearhart Industries. I think most of what I had written down to say has already been said. There's two sides to every story, and it seems to go on and on. One thing that we've heard over and over, I've been started the service business in the state of Alaska in 1969. I was never advised of any change in any rule, anywhere, at any time. First became aware of this change when we were approached by PACE people in Houston, and became aware of what was going on. We were not on an FWW plan. It was similar. We named it differently. It paid differently. Frightened us a little bit. High price group of attorneys in Anchorage and researched the law. They did a good job on it. And we changed. And we changed in May of 1982. And as of this moment, we're just squeaky clean as far as I'm concerned. We pay our people 24 hours a day. There's no time card flogging or nothing. When they get on the plane in Anchorage, their time starts. And they come home 2 weeks later, and their time stops. they don't like it as well as they did the previous plan that we changed with. They don't have the option at the busy times to make the big paychecks. They can go to the bank now and say, I'm making $68,000 a year. I'm working half time. And they've got it in black and white. They could not do that before. But they also had the option to make a lot more money before. The date we changed, in May of 82, we extrapolated some salaries. And I think people here agree with me, the business was starting down a little bit, but it's going on. We had some people on $100,000 collision course, unskilled workers. $1,981 dollars, we were running $55,000 to $80,000 a year for these same workers. I think House Bill 223 is a good bill. I don't believe the industries were properly notified. The reason we're in with this PESA group is to keep abreast of these things. We had to protect ourselves somehow, and this seemed to be the way to do it. Those people stay on top of it, and we get our notices from it. Some of the horror stories about the long hours, I'll agree with some of them, but I think that day is over. So High and Arco both will not let you stay on the job more than 12 hours in one day. And that's our time down pretty good. I believe John will agree with me. I heard some talk a little earlier about abuse to the legislature. The legislature wasn't in on this. This bill was passed or put into law or administrative, however you want to say it. Our protection in the industry is to get these things in the open in a committee such as this, to where there's a record, everybody knows what's going on. And hopefully Mr. Robinson will, he's not here now, keep everybody well notified of it. We've no qualms about obeying the law. We didn't know we were breaking the law. We suspected we might have been. We changed. Our people don't really like what we've got now, but it is the law. We're paying the less salary, and we've got less people. And we just 2 weeks ago changed to an even schedule, 2 and 2. Further saved us $80,000 a year. And we're using exactly the same number of people. So anybody got any questions of me? Mr. Hayes brought it. Good question. How did these claims get so high? It's the way that the Department of Labor figures the hourly rate after they've gone through the 40, the slide, plus the bonus. If a man has worked 100 hours in a week and his bonus brings that up to a $2,000 paycheck, they feel it. That's $20 an hour, straight time. So they go back for 40. So he's got 40 hours at $20 an hour. He's got 60 hours at $30 an hour. And this shoots those figures sky high. And I think everything else has been pretty well gone over. Is there a question, gentlemen?
Did you have any questions in the committee of Mr. Sheehan? Representative Whitney?
I guess I'd have to commend Ohio and ARCO on that they don't let people work over 12 hours, because I don't have any questions for you, and my 12 hours ended 2 hours ago. It's my show, the difference between this afternoon and tonight.
I'd like to remind you, Representing Whitney, that you are in an exempt category. God's whole statute doesn't apply to you or me. Mr. Sheehan, how many employees do you have? Can you give somebody the size?
50.
50? And how many years have you operated in Alaska?
Since 1969.
Since 1969.
We didn't have 50 then, we had two.
Yeah, but you've operated continuously since 1969 in the state. And never during this period of time when the Department of Labor was going through these supposed machinations about changing this, were you notified of any changes?
Never.
Did anybody in your company bring to your attention these ads that supposedly appeared?
No.
You know, I hate to keep saying it, but that is so important to me. I keep having this strange feeling that the Department of Labor, you know, somehow terribly remiss in what they did here.
No, it's awfully important to us. It really is. One thing that really seemed to stick out, and I may be a little off, but it seems that after the Dow L hearing, that this was administered into law in a period of a month and a half or 2 months. That's awful quick.
Yeah, I looked at those dates and it somehow came very quickly to me too.
It's almost as if it was well, I'm not saying.
How many, in 1978, when all this was going on, you were certainly aware that companies around were working the flex fleet.
Oh, yes, so yes.
It obviously was general knowledge to the Department of Labor that many companies were working this way, was it not?
Had to have been.
Obviously, just because of the Dow L problem, they must have known approximately how many companies worked.
I don't know. I never communicated with any of them. They never communicated with me. It's a good, equitable system. Our people liked it. It wasn't a true FWW. We called it a salary plus halftime, and it paid more. But it was still illegal because it slid for a short period of hours. And it was illegal because you could not at any hour in that slide tell your employee exactly what he was making per hour. And that's the way we interpret that law. That man has to know each and every hour exactly what he's making. And you couldn't do it under that system. That was a complicated system. I did not have an employee that couldn't figure his paycheck out to the penny.
Yeah, I've been around the industry for a long time, and I don't know that there's very many people on the North Slope that can't figure that out. I have no problem with that myself. Are there further questions of Mr. Sheehan? If not, thank you very much for coming down and making yourself available to the company or to the committee.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Larry Compton.
Written statement.
I have a written statement that's been put in the packets of everybody. He'd like this read into the record. If Mr. Becker would like to read this into the record, I'd appreciate it. It's a short statement, and to accommodate him, he's from out of town, and he'd like to read it in.
Very happy to, Mr. Chairman. Larry Compton did fly up from Seattle and unfortunately had to go back for pressing business. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Compton, president and owner of Time Saver Grocery Incorporated. I have lived in Alaska since 1954 and, may I add, have no connections with the gas and oil industry. I regret that I was unable to stay and testify in person. I have nothing to gain by this passage of House Bill 223. However, I do feel I have something to lose if it fails. I will lose faith in the system that has been fair and equitable in my eyes for 30 years, a system that is supposed to deal fairly with employee and employer alike. I only ask that you continue to apply that same fairness in the future by passing House Bill 223, and it's signed by Larry Compton.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Now, possibly we can go down to Richard Grill.
Cool.
Oh, cruel, it's a C, cruel, excuse me.
Sir, I could give you part of your time back here.
And I just have to, you have to get down with, otherwise we don't get you picked up, recorded. We are making an official record, I'm sorry about that. Since we are recording electronically, I'll have to ask you to state your name for the record and then put your story in real quick.
Okay, my name is Richard Cruel. I'm the regional operations manager for Dowlin, Alaska. The bad guy. Since I have only been in this position about 7 months, I don't think I could add any more to what's already been said. I would like to say that I am here to show that our company does favor House Bill 223. That's about it.
Representative Hayes?
How do you spell the name of your company? We've been using it quite a bit tonight, and I don't know that I've ever seen the name, or if I have, I don't get it out.
D-O-W-E-L-L.
Yes, sir. D-O-W-E-L-L? It is a division of the Dow Chemical Company, and that's where you get the D-O-W.
E-L-L?
E-L-L. And you're the general manager, right?
The regional operations manager for Alaska.
Thank you.
Representative Wendy?
Are you a member of the, whatever it's called, the Alliance, Alaska Support Industry Alliance?
Yes, sir.
What, do you know, when was it, when were you formed?
1979. December 1979.
December of 1979. Are you a member of the PESA or?
PESA.
PESA?
Yes, sir.
When was that formed?
Here again, I don't know. I think not too awful long ago.
I can keep it here.
That's fine. What? So, are you aware of any communications? I assume it's a pretty close knit. Maybe it's not so close knit. I don't know the nature of the companies we're talking about. Since your company was directly in. Involved because it started with you.
1976.
You don't communicate with other firms and through trade associations or in any way discuss these types of matters so that Dressler and others might be aware of the discussions you were having with the Department of Labor?
As I stated earlier, I've only been here 7 months.
That's probably not a fair question.
I would like to be making an assumption if I made a statement.
Is Dowell a party of the lawsuit of these?
Not that I'm aware of. No.
Mr. Grell, if the committee wanted to get information from your company directly, to answer questions that we might have with respect to how the original challenge to your company came about when you submitted the briefs to along with the Department of Labor to the AG's office back in 78, which was before the regulations were even considered to be adopted, would your company make that available to us?
I would have to assume yes.
You know, my reason for doing that, I'll do it in open committee and tell you why. But, you know, I'd like to know why or how the original challenge came to the company, and I'd like to know what records or documents are available at that time. It seems that there's a conspicuous absence from the Department of Labor for any documents for that period of time. I'd like to know what you have that may have come from the Department of Labor at that time. Maybe that will help us somehow find records on behalf of the state in that period of time so that we can see what happened.
I can see what I can do, but to add a little bit to what I have heard about this, and here again, I'm assuming, but I think the Alaska Labor
board found that we were not the FWW, as they thought we were. So this is the way I hear it.
Well, I understand that, but the FWW wasn't illegal at that time, and there has to be some reason and something behind whatever they were trying to prove or disprove at that time. And if there's a complaint or if there's... If somebody did more than just walk into the front door of Dollar Hall and say, hey, you guys are... Or maybe they didn't, I don't know.
Yeah.
Someone apparently like us believe that. I have to believe that there's something in writing someplace.
I'll make an effort.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that if we could stay in contact. I have your name and address, and I'd like to pursue that.
Mr. Chairman, could you represent with me? Maybe I missed something. Didn't we have testimony earlier tonight that they pulled documents out of archives this afternoon? And
there was.
Have they presented those to us? Or?
Well, you have those, and he has the brief he's brought down. We don't have these yet, those he pulled out, but that there must be some documents from the Department of Labor somehow that caused somebody to go to Dowell for whatever the reason.
And that's not
it. And they, and obviously, if what I'm saying, or trying to say, I guess, is that if in less than 60 days after that or so, all of a sudden we got a regulation on the books and they weren't made part of a hearing or aren't recorded or aren't something, now, I guess I just have a question with what the state was doing there and how come. Ron?
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't 60 days, it was a year and 2 months.
Okay, well, whatever the time was.
Maybe the best thing is just to have a copy of this file that I got out of archives made for your reference. What brought the whole matter up to the Department of Law was a wage claim filed by an employee of Dowell named Kluting, R. Kluting, I don't know what his first name was, for about $4,000 based on his view that he hadn't been paid overtime as he was entitled to under the law. That got the whole discussion with Dowell going, the decision between the Department of Labor and Dowell to submit briefs to the Department of Law, my issuing an opinion on that. It started as a wage claim by one individual.
Well, I guess
in 1977.
I guess what I'm looking for is where is the paperwork in the Department of Labor? And if this was that serious an issue at that time, you know, why isn't that, or how come that didn't get made a part of anything, or what's going on? Maybe there's nothing to it, I don't know.
My advice as a result of that wage claim was that the guy didn't have a claim, so they probably closed it out, and probably the records retention doesn't call for them keeping closed wage claims for 5 years. So they probably just got rid of those records, not thinking they needed them anymore.
So you obviously have some of them.
What I have is the file that they... You know, the request they sent to me.
I can see right now that Mr. Miller is going to end up at a hearing, and I'd like to have that to be able to chat with him about, you know, what he thought, because I have had a conversation with Mr. Miller and on a couple of occasions, and quite frankly, I'm further mystified after I talked to him, and I need to have that. Whatever's happening there.
I'd be happy to let you have a copy.
Oh, I'd love that. Thank you. Are there further questions of Mr. Grove? Not. Thank you so much for coming and making yourself available to the committee. We have one more out of town witness that be signed up, Paul Preston.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Preston. I'm the Alaska manager for Halliburton Services. And about all I want to say, everything's pretty well been said. I would just like to add our support to this bill. We think it's good legislation, and we encourage the passing of it. That's just about the extent of mine.
Well, we needed more witnesses like you. Remember Dave Hayes?
Mr. Preston?
Yes, sir.
Is Halliburton Services a party to the lawsuit?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Are there other questions of Mr. Preston? If not, boy, thank you very much, Mr. Preston, for coming down and making this out available.
I bit my tongue, you should thank me.
Yeah,
too.
I just. now, you know, we can go back to the regular list here, and Tom Suffol is... Thank you for being so patient. We're finally back to the regular list of things.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tom Suffol. I'm employed by the Legislative Affairs Agency as a legislative counsel in the Legal Services Division across the street. We drafted the subject bill. There really is no need at this point, I don't think, in my opinion, to go into any complicated legal analysis. The office basically would agree with everything Mr. Lawrenson has said. I think there are a few caveats, though. I think there have been some misimpressions created as to certain ways we might be able to address this and improve on the bill. First of all, it is, of course, not, and I'm sure you're already aware of this, within the purview of our review of these bills to comment on the advisability on a policy matter as to whether there should or should not be a flexible work week. We have no opinion as to that, nor do we have any opinion as to whether people on the slope are being overpaid or underpaid under either of the two plans. Nor do we have any legal analysis, which we have done regarding Section 2 of the bill, which involves the penal provisions, although we would add that, in our view, that provision is less likely than a toss-up to withstand court challenge. I believe Mr. Lawrenson said he thought that might be 50-50 on a constitutional matter. We would probably give it one chance out of three if those things can be quantified. As you know, I am the attorney for each of you at this table, and the function we have is to protect the work product of the legislature. I would just reiterate what Mr. Lawrenson said. This is a loser. You are certainly at least buying a lawsuit by passing it, and you're probably, in fact, most probably, every attorney that has reviewed this bill across the street would predict, and it's all it can be is a prediction. We can't assure this, and it may be the right thing to do, which is to pass it and give it its day in court. But if we were advising clients, this is the kind of case that we would consider to be almost a certain loser. Now, there have been a couple impressions created, I think, by testimony which maybe didn't directly state these facts, but these were the impressions I came away with. One was that if we could include the proper amount of findings or purpose as an addendum to this bill on the front end of it, that we could somehow cure the unconstitutionality if it is indeed unconstitutional. And I will try to remember to continue to say if, because we don't have any statement to that effect now from a judicial forum that we're bound by. And I do agree with Mr. Fleischer's statement earlier when he submitted, I guess, a summary of his brief. There are no cases directly on point. So in one sense, this is an issue that the court could look at anew. But if they follow the authority that seems to be in the field, they will probably strike it down as unconstitutional. And we who deal in these areas as to legislative findings and intent and purpose are aware of a long line of cases which shows on various subjects that it is seldom, if ever, the case that you can cure the unconstitutionality of a bill by merely stating that the legislature finds X and X to be the case. Not when the flaw in it is of a constitutional magnitude. There is another impression, which I'm not sure where I've come by this information. It was in the course of drafting and listening today. I've heard the Cease case referred to several times as one of the primary cases that's most likely to be used in an argument to support the bill, and I agree it most likely would be used in support. It's one of the strongest cases in support of this kind of legislation. And although I don't have the full copy of the case with me, and in fact, at the moment, I don't even think I have a summary with me, I have read the case, and although no one has misstated any statements in the case, they have failed to tell you that even the Portal Act, which was sustained in that case, did not allow for the withdrawal of the remedy if there was a written contract governing that right under question. Now, no one has said that it did, but everyone has failed to state that that was clearly one of the exceptions, that if there was a written contract which protected that right, even the Portal Act didn't purport to revoke that right. And the other thing that I think I would like to focus the committee's attention on is that the constitutionality of this bill does not depend at all on the amount of money that's involved. It doesn't matter what anyone's getting paid, and it doesn't matter whether the damages are $10 or $10 million. The court in question to which this may end up going would decide if there are indeed damages. It may be unconstitutional even if there's no recovery. And I think a lot of discussion has involved what the amount of money is, and although that is of some interest, and for instance on a close call of public policy purposes, it might be relevant. Really, for the kinds of defects that we see in the bill, which are the impairment of contracts, probably an equal protection argument, and also probably special legislation, which I think all of those have been discussed fully before, almost all of those arguments will not be affected by whether the recovery is $1 or $1 million. The office really has not responded to any requests to research this thoroughly. We certainly have nothing like a 30-page memorandum. I didn't know we were going to be asked to testify here today until 4:30 yesterday. So we're prepared to answer questions or do the appropriate research if anyone cares to pose a question which we can't answer at this time. That's the only statement we were prepared to make. I'm open for questions.
Representative Wente?
I certainly wish you well in trying to pick myself and 59 colleagues of many diverse opinions. There seems to be a strong indication from previous attorneys for the state that this is indeed special interest legislation and falls within the realms of the statutes that deal with that. Would you care to express your opinion on whether this is special interest legislation?
A memo I wrote raised the question that it raised the point that this might be considered to be because of the way it was phrased. Where all retroactive clauses when we're drafting legislation are inherently suspect. We're always looking to make sure that we're not carving out a special class of people. And until really the committee started taking testimony, I did not know the names of the various defendants that might be involved. But it was clear that there was going to be some group of people or businesses or whatever that would be affected in a way that some others wouldn't. Special legislation is a rather generic way to describe that, and it wasn't meant when we raised that in a short memo that I believe the committee requested at some point, it wasn't meant to propose on our part that we knew precisely whose special interest would be served. I'm not sure that I have any facts in my file or in my knowledge, even from listening here today, that I could identify for sure whose special interest would be. But it seems to be, it's the kind of analysis that's always attached to a bill where there's retroactive applications being sought that will apply to some people and apparently not to others. So no, I do not know for certain what special interest will be served and to what amount, although I suspect the testimony that you're taking here will further elucidate that. I mean, we could guess from what we've heard that Dresser Industries would be one special interest, but that's not meant to be in itself a negative term or connotation. Everyone that comes to the legislature in a certain sense has a special interest.
Are there further questions of committee members or Mr. Stuckel? If not, I just have one little question. You say you weren't, you didn't know until 4:30 you were going to testify.
4:30 yesterday, Mr. Chairman.
Or requested to testify. Who requested you to testify?
Mr. Foxon did, and apparently his son was taken ill today, and that I think was the cause of some confusion as to when I was supposed to be here and when I wasn't supposed to be here.
Okay. One question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Stoffel, did you draft up this original bill 223? Were you involved in it?
The office did the work request. I have drafted some version of it, including the version that's in front of you. I don't recall from my memory whether I worked on every single version of it that has come out of the office. But the version that you are using now is one which I drafted, yes.
The reason why I ask you this particular question, when we request a, when I do, I know, when I request a subject or a bill to be drawn up, I expect a proper amount of research is done on it. So to get it in proper language and what research is available to you people. So my question to you is this, how much research actually went into this?
When the bill was originally requested, our first order of business, of course, is to get the bill into some working language. Subsequent to that, after we reviewed the content, I think within a day or so later, we followed it up with a memo saying that the bill presents some red flags to us, just to put someone on notice that there are potential problems with the bill. That is not at all unusual. There often are. Sometimes we're wrong, sometimes we're right. Until we're asked to look into those issues, those areas which we raised, which were mainly of constitutional nature, which the other attorneys here today have mentioned, until we're asked to look into those areas in more detail, we don't brief them in a way that we would if we were going to court to defend one side or another on this. All we can do with the press of business across the street, usually, unless someone asks for a special brief on these things, is to just raise the red flag, and if someone's interested in finding out how serious the defect is, they will come back and ask us to do more research, and if we have the time, certainly we do. In this case, we've only done preliminary research. Mr. Fleischer, as he stated, if he's seen a copy of a memo I wrote, it was indeed a short memo, probably only a couple pages, and involved no case citation.
Any further questions of Mr. Sutton? If not, thank you very much for coming down. I know what you're looking at to watch. We only have two more witnesses signed, and possibly we can get these in by 10. We have Joan Metcalf is... Who? Boy, what absence. And Tom Cash is here, though. And...
Thank you, Mr.
Tom,
Chairman.
Since we're recording electronically, I need to have you state your name for the record before you proceed with your statement, and then please do.
My name is Tom Cashin. I'm an electrician. I lobby for my union during legislative sessions. I hate to badmouth this bill too much. The sponsor is a good IBW union contractor. Well, the hour's getting late. Without rehashing everything, we don't think it's good legislation. We'd hope it would die in committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I don't know why you just mealy mouthed about it. You ought to just say what you think about it.
I might have to work for you next year. It's a small industry.
Are there questions of Mr. Cash from committee members? I only have one, Tom, but did you ever take a job when you had problems figuring out your paycheck?
Never have.
Did you ever know any of those electricians that had a problem figuring out their paycheck? If there are no other questions of committee members, Tom, we do thank you for sitting through the whole thing. And I know, had we called you earlier, you'd had a lot to say, but a lot got said in the interim. So, is there anybody else present that, we got a hand up, and obviously I'll have you on the thing. If you come at this time. I beg your pardon?
I didn't sign in, I'll be very brief.
All right. Since we are recording electronic, you have to have your name for the record, please, and then proceed with your statement.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is James Wakefield. I'm a lobbyist for Labor's Local 942. I will not say very much because most of the things that have been said here today pretty well state our position. I will just basically say that we are in agreement with those in opposition to this bill. We think it was very bad legislation and would be a very poor precedent for the state to set. I will entertain any questions anyone would like to have might like that.
Are there questions to the committee members or Mr. Wakefield? Mr. Wakefield, are you from Juneau?
Yes.
The Labor's Union was what number?
Local 942.
Are there further witnesses present that would like to expand the record with anything at this time?
Mr. Chairman, I'd certainly hope that the committee would follow the recommendation of the last two speakers, primarily because of the issue of the bill, but also strongly so that I don't want to have to go through this again in Labor and Commerce Committee.
I think that's sufficient reason to move rapidly with the bill and get it out of committee. If there are no further witnesses present that wish to testify, the committee will indeed endeavor to set a teleconference up, even if we have to establish a quorum and I have to sit through it to expand the record, which I've done in the past. I'll do it again if I need to be. We'll as quickly as we can make some teleconference time available and notify the people, we will do that. And if there's nothing further to come before the committee at this time, I will adjourn for the evening. Until tomorrow at 1:30.